The following program contains the opinions of the host, guests, and call-in participants. These do not necessarily represent the views of this show's distributors or sponsors. This program may contain obscene, profane, or otherwise objectionable language. Viewer discretion is advised. Look into the camera and smile, Jim. Hi, everybody. It's 11:02 p.m. on the East Coast of the United States, 8:02 on the West Coast, 2:02 in the afternoon in Sydney, Australia, and 10:02 p.m. here where I sit in Northeast Minneapolis. I'm Jim Peters, and welcome to another edition of Jim Peters at Night. And I just realized I forgot to check the episode number today. I was going to tell you folks, I think this is around 45. Yesterday, we had our 300th anniversary. So far, so good, I guess. So, tonight, our guest is David Strom, the associate editor of HotAir.com. Here's the problem. You get David and I together, and David actually lives in Minneapolis, too. That's not why I actually know him. I know him from his work at Hot Air, and that's how we actually met. And it just turns out he lives here. Remember, he lives a couple miles from our studio here. So you get us together, and we just yak like old ladies forever. So this interview's 65 minutes long, and I was telling him at the end, and it's true, and I think I was talking about this last night too, you know, I was, because I was talking about Elon Musk was on Joe Rogan again, either second or third appearance on that, and they talked for 2.5 hours, and you gotta love Rogan. He's a pioneer, he's very good at what he does, he is easily the biggest podcaster in the world, no question. His contract at Spotify is up for renewal this coming year, and like somebody said, they'd be nuts if they don't renew it, even though they're paying him about $100 million a year. But it's been pointed out that if he actually did the show on his own and like hired people to do it, he could probably make double that, believe it or not. His audience is unbelievable. He has about, if I'm right, I think about 11 million people watch every show, which is, in term, if you're going to do that, use that in terms of the news business, that's monumental. I mean, right now, I think about each of the evening newscasts only gets about 3 million viewers, maybe less. The highest rated show on cable television news, and cable television period, actually, is The Five on Fox News, and that gets 3 million people a day. And Joe's getting almost 4 times that much. I mean, it's really amazing. But you have to understand, he started in this, and him and Adam Carolla were the two big pioneers. The first 10 years that they were, quote-unquote, on the air, podcasting, they made no money whatsoever. None. Zero. For 10 years, they made no money. They did it every day. Both those guys have been doing podcasts 5 days a week for, I think now, 14 years now, maybe 15, something like that. First 10 years, nothing. Zip. Nobody even knew about podcasting the first 5 years, 6 years they were doing it. So, I mean, you know, that's the strength of sticking to it, man. There you go. And now they're both wildly rich. So, yeah, is that going to happen to me? No, I will run out of time. I'm 68. I'm looking in the mirror today, and I realize, my God, my eyebrows are finally starting to turn gray. Jesus Christ. Shit. Oh, so as Murray Shadman was on yesterday, I just want to point out, and David was on today, I will have links up to all their stuff tomorrow. Okay, this coming week, I have yet to book guests for Monday and Tuesday. Wednesday, we're doing a debate night. It's another Republican primary debate. We'll have a panel discussion as soon as the debate's done. Once again, as previously, you know, I might be wrong about this. I got to check. I thought the debate was going to end 11 p.m. Eastern, but it might not. It might be ending at like an hour early. I got to check on that. Well, anyway, we will go live as soon as the debate's done, within minutes, whatever that is. I'm assuming it's going to be 11 p.m. Eastern. Maybe not. If it isn't, we'll go live an hour earlier. We will. So we'll have a panel discussion of that. Thursday, I'm taking off. I got to go out of town for a funeral. you know, when you're my age, people die, you know, it's like, it's terrible, you know, but that's life. And, yeah. And so, David and I yakking about all sorts of crap, and that'll be coming up in a few minutes. So, that's my rundown for tonight. So what are we going to talk about? I'll tell you what we're going to talk about. Joe Biden got another $40,000 check today from his brother. That's really great. Yeah, so you tell me that these people aren't on the take. And, you know, the Republicans are saying, well, he wasn't in office, and there's no, you know, it's a loan repayment. Oh, fuck, it is not. If this was put in regular court and he was like a regular guy, he would be going to prison. And Sam Bankman-Fried, the guy from FTX, was sentenced today. No, he wasn't sentenced. He was found guilty. I don't know how many counts he was found guilty on, but the important thing is that the jury came to a conclusion. They came to a decision in 4 hours. I mean, even, what's his name? Bernie Madoff. Even for Bernie Madoff, they took 4 days. It took 4 days. 4 hours, they came to a decision. And apparently this guy made an ass out of himself on the stand. He decided to take the stand in his own defense and came off looking like an absolute idiot. Matter of fact, that's probably what completely killed him, that put the nail in the coffin. Because there are plenty, the state had plenty of witnesses against him. That wasn't a problem. And so then they put him on the stand and they asked him questions. He said, I don't remember. You know, I wasn't keeping track of that stuff. Oh, fuck you. Jesus Christ. So Joe got another check today. And so this is last week he got a $200,000 one. This week, now, no, he did not get these checks recently. These have just been discovered, of course. They discovered the $200,000 one last week. They discovered $40,000 this week. So written from his brother, and it says in the memo line, it says loan prepayment. Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, you tell me about it. And it turns out that $40,000 is exactly one-tenth of a $400,000 check that Hunter got from China and then passed on to his uncle. So, you know, every family in America has 20 shell companies that do absolutely nothing. And also, here's the real nail in this coffin as far as, like, you know, like I said, if he was anybody other than the president, this would absolutely seal it. What are they selling? Why is this money changing hands? Goods and services, you know, it's a market thing, you know. You provide a good or service, somebody pays you. What are they paying them for? And no one can come up with an answer. I have an answer. Access to Joe. That's what they're paying him for. It's duh. I mean, the thing is, you know, the Democrats are saying, well, he wasn't in office. There's no evidence that he, you know, they did anything wrong. Yeah, there is. You're getting money for no reason. I mean, like I said, in a regular court of law, if it was a regular person, this would be a slam dunk. It's unbelievable. Not to mention the fact, as I've brought this up a million times, because the thing is, legally, this qualifies as easily as bribery, that Joe Biden's minor grandchildren have gotten money directly from China. 10-year-old kids. So what are they selling, you know? And, yeah, no, don't go there. No, we're not even going to deal with that sort of evil shit. Don't go there. No, they have nothing to sell. That's right. No, the money's going there because their grandfather told them to send it there. That's the reason. And in a normal court of law, once again, that's considered bribery. You don't have to get the money. If your friend, I didn't even know this. I thought your family gets it. Even if you have friends that get the money, that's considered bribery. It doesn't matter whether you get it or not. So that happened today. And the other thing that happened is that it turns out that Mike Johnson, the new Speaker of the House, apparently is living paycheck to paycheck. He has no assets. Apparently he doesn't even have a bank account. And amazingly, this is how fucked up everything's gotten in America, folks. Amazingly, the Dems are giving him shit about this because apparently he wasn't smart enough to get on the dole and get money from China, apparently, because he's, you know, he's like honest. he has no income other than his income as a member of the House of Representatives. Isn't that the way it's supposed to work? Isn't that the way, you know, the founding fathers set this stuff up? You have to understand there's a flaw in the Constitution. They did not put in term limits. Even the one for the president's been added after the fact. They did not put in terms of limits because it never occurred to them anybody would want to make a permanent job out of any of this. It never occurred to them. So they, and you think about all the stuff in the Constitution that did occur to them. I mean, it's unbelievable how many holes they plugged before the fact. I mean, shit. I mean, really, it's really amazing. And yet, you know, that, well, no one's going to go to Washington for 40 years. That's never going to happen. Oh, excuse me. You know, so here's a guy. Yeah, what's your income, Mike Johnson? Oh, I work for at the House. I'm a representative of the House of Representatives. How much you get paid? What, $173,000 a year, whatever it is? What else do you do? Nothing. And apparently that's bad. And they're making fun of him. That's the hilarious part. They're making fun of him for this because he wasn't smart enough to get on the dole. It's like, Jesus Christ almighty. It's like, shit. It's bizarro world. We're all living in Superman, Jerry Seinfeld bizarro world. It's like unbelievable. Unbelievable. So I'm going to mention a couple more things here before we run the interview. Oh, by the way, yeah, we taped the interview this afternoon. So I've already done it. I know what happens. Oh, and this, I put this in the explanation or the description of our show tonight because this is, you want to hear something else nuts? This is an actual headline from Fox News today. Golf influencer Paige Spiriak addresses questions about her chest. The human body is a magical thing, quote unquote. Yeah, that's. That was a headline on the Fox News website. That, there you go. Questions about her. And the teaser said burning questions about her chest. Yeah, we got a lot of questions, man. Like, you know, because apparently people say, well, you know, her tits are fake. I can say that here. What am I talking about? I've been trained too much radio. You know, I can say, you know, I have no trouble saying the F word, but I had to think about saying tits. So, yeah. Yeah, people think her tits are fake. Well, seriously, the world has gone mad. This is what we're writing about. This is what's on the front page of a major website or newspaper, whatever the hell you want to call it. You know, we're talking about Paige Spiriak's tits. That's great. That's fantastic. I've seen the pictures. They look okay. What am I supposed to say? Like, Jesus. Man, oh God, this is crazy shit. Yeah, so, and then I have some UFO news too. And I'm going to usually I do that at the end, but this interview is so long that we're just going to can the show at the end. By the way, if you want to call me up, you better do it right now. Cause you know, the interview is pre-taped and then we're done. So, here's a couple of pieces of UFO news that there's an ex-Navy admiral who claims that they have discovered off the coast of California something that could be an underwater UFO base. This has been rumored for years. It's right off Catalina Island. Now, I don't even know this. Catalina Island is a relatively large island right off the coast of Los Angeles, or actually kind of Long Beach. It's kind of between L.A. and San Diego there. And there's a town there called Avalon. I've been there a couple times. It's actually stunning and beautiful. It's a great place to vacation. It is. But it's been rumored for years that not that there was an underwater base, but people have seen UFOs going into the ocean there. And this is also where the Nimitz incident of 2014 happened. And it was this very, very area. Now, they've done scans now of the ocean floor around Catalina Island, and there's a really, really weird thing there. It basically looks like a shelf, except it's too geometrically perfect to be a natural phenomena. And there are people who are starting to think, this was an ex-U.S. Navy admiral who said, the guy's name is Tim Goliat, if I'm right. That is either a underwater UFO base or it's the entrance to one or the other. So, because people have been seeing this for years and years, not just the Navy, even people who live on the coast there by Catalina have been seeing UFOs going in and out of the water. You know, So who knows? And he says that needs to be investigated, and it does. And then Leslie Keene has come out. And this is really interesting. Okay, Leslie Keene is an investigative journalist. She is a woman who actually wrote the article in the New York Times in December 2017 that said the government basically had confirmed the existence of UFOs. It was her article, her and a guy named Ralph Blumenthal and one other guy who I've never heard of. They wrote the article. She has been writing stories about UFOs for some time. And also, she's basically devoted the last half of her career not just to UFOs, but to paranormal phenomena in general. I've read this book. I highly recommend it. I've actually tried to get her on the show. It's almost impossible to contact her. I am able to get a hold of her. The book is called Surviving Death. You can buy it at Amazon. I've not only read it, I sent it to a couple of friends of mine, too. And it basically talks about near-death or after-death experiences that people have. So I assume you've heard about this. A guy named Raymond Moody actually did the first actual documented research of this in the 1970s, that there's a lot of people who, when they either come close to death or temporarily die, however you want to put it, you know, their heart and even their brains stop working for a period of time, and then they're either revived, or in a few really weird cases, they just come back to life, that a lot of those people have experiences while they're quote-unquote dead, and those experiences are remarkably the same. And so there's been two theories on this. Either something's really happening, they do go somewhere, or the other theory is that your brain is designed as a comfort mechanism when you're dying to play the script. That it's kind of genetically built into your brain. And that's a logical thing, too. Except the weird thing is there's people who have reported people who say this happens to them said the first thing that happens is they leave their body. And the weird thing about that is there's people who have left their bodies who travel around in the hospital, wherever they're at, and hear conversations that are nowhere near close to where their body actually is. And then after they resume life, when they come back to life, they tell people about these conversations and they're confirmed. That's the weird part. It's very, very difficult to explain that other than the fact that they were actually there, you know. So she says, anyway, her latest thing is, and I think there's something to this, that she thinks that the UFO phenomena and ghosts and this thing about near-death experiences all maybe somehow share some weird alternate dimension. And I think there might be something to that. People have studied the ghost phenomena, and a lot of people don't believe in ghosts. There's two different type of ghosts, I have to tell you this right off the hand. There's ghosts that seem to replay a scene completely oblivious to anybody watching them. There's a very, very famous case of this. There's a house, or I think it's a barn, actually. No, now it's a house. It was a barn in England, in the middle of nowhere, in some countryside, where hundreds of people have stood in the basement and said they've seen a Roman army march not only at them, but right through them. It's apparently really, really wild, and a lot of people have seen this. And it turns out that the basement of that building was 2,000 years ago on the main floor. It was actually on the ground. And so the theory or whatever is that this is a replay of something that happened then when the Romans invaded England. And that makes sense, you know. But the thing is, the soldiers in that marching formation are completely oblivious to anybody they're walking toward. They don't respond to anything. And it's the same scene replayed over and over again. There's some weird thing. There's people who think that certain, like walls or certain materials might actually be able to actually have some sort of like screen memory where that the event is imprinted physically onto the walls of the structure. Most of these reports happen inside buildings. I've never heard of one that's happened actually out in the open. I haven't. But there's a lot of people who report these scenes, even like quote-unquote haunted houses. But the ghosts are completely oblivious to anybody watching them, and they don't interact. You see the scene, and the people who see it say they see the same scene over and over again. Now, I don't know if that's ghosts. Like I said, that might be some sort of weird metaphysical recording thing. But on the other hand, there are ghosts that do interact with people. There's that too, you know. And I've seen a couple. I got to be honest with you. I lived in a very, very, I grew up in a very, very old house, Yeah, so I mean, and the house was haunted. I don't know how else to tell you. It's like it just was. You know, I saw shit. So, and that stuff did interact with me. So, you know, and then you wonder, well, where are those people? You know, if this is real, and I can buy the fact it's real. And I mean, I was talking last night. I don't know what we were talking about, but I think I ended the show with this. I'm of the opinion that there's something going on this planet, in our world, in our universe, that we are completely and totally unaware of. I do think that. Now, one of Keane's propositions, and other people too, has said that there's maybe an alternate reality. And you kind of think about it like this. Like, there's an alternate reality that's like 15 minutes behind us. So it's like we're sharing the same space, but what's happening in that world is 15 minutes behind what's happening in ours. And therefore, we never interact, or we hardly ever do. Something weird happens and the things cross, you know. I've read that people who say they've seen ghosts, I did not see this, but people who have seen ghosts have said that they've seen ghosts fade in and out of the view or existence in kind of a crisscross pattern, almost like they were being pushed through a screen, you know. Anyway, this is what Keane is talking about here. She thinks that all these things are somehow related by this. And although there's definitely a nuts and bolts component to UFOs, like the government has acknowledged, they're real flying machines. They're flying around. I'm reading a book right now. I'm trying to get this woman. She does a podcast. I'm trying to get her on the show. Her name is Kelly Chase. And she wrote a book called Down the UFO Rabbit Hole. And she talks about all the things UFOs could be. And she mentions, basically, she's talking about the same stuff I've talked about the fact that, the government refuses to say the A word, aliens. They admit that as far as anyone knows, no country on Earth is building these things. And it's way beyond the technology that we have available at the present time. So if it's not us, who is it, right? Well, duh. You know, it's the aliens. But she also talks about there's other alternatives. It could be it could be humans from the future, and there's a lot of people who have said that. Jim Peniston, who was at the event at Rendlesham Forest at the U.S. Army base there in 1980, he thinks it's humans from the future. He wrote down a binary code that he said was transmitted to him when he touched that actual spacecraft. He was the only person that actually touched it. And he said, well, as soon as he touched it, his mind was flooded with ones and zeros. And he wrote them down, which is amazing that you could remember that spaceship, but he did. And he wrote them down, and he didn't realize what it was. It was in a notebook. And 40 years later, I can't remember the name of the guy who was with him on that hike, said, what is this? And he said, well, this, I remember these from when I touched the spacecraft. He said, well, this is binary code. This is computer code. And they sent it off to a bunch of computer guys. And I read an interview with the guy who actually decoded it. And he said, oh, this is just bullshit. You know, and he started punching it in. And lo and behold, that is not bullshit. It came out in English. That's the real amazing thing. But in that code, it said the date was 8600. Well, so about what? 300 years from now, you know? So, it's all mind-boggling. It's a clusterfuck. You know, who are we kidding, you know? But, yeah, I think there's some way more shit going on here than we are aware of. And I think she's alluding to that. That's what she's talking about. She is such a busy woman. I would love to talk to her, but she will never come on the show. But Kelly Chase, maybe. So we'll talk. That book is pretty good. I'm not done with it. I could recommend it. It's called Down the UFO Rabbit Hole. You can get it on Amazon, and it's based on her podcasts. She does a podcast called Down the UFO Rabbit Hole. That's the podcast she does. So, and the other book that I was talking about last night is called Dark White. It's called by a guy named Jim Schnabel. He spent like 3 years investigating not just the UFO phenomena, but the culture behind it. And he came to the conclusion, basically, I come to the conclusion. He said, there's definitely a truth. There's a truth, kernel of truth, to almost all of this, but the vast majority of it is bullshit. And he's right. It is. You got your scammers. You got your people trying to make money off of it. You got your crazy people who think it's really happened to them. You know, and even he said that. It's not so, you know, John Mack, the guy who investigated all the abductees before he was killed in that traffic accident, he's the guy who was the head of psychiatry at Harvard. He said it wasn't so much that he was sure these events happened to these people. He's talking about alien abductions. But they believe it. And that's true. It's not that these people are lying or some of them are scam artists. But the majority of them, it's not that they're lying. They really think this stuff happened to them. But whether it really did, I don't know. And then, of course, the weird thing is you have the exception that proves the rule. There's a few of these incidents, especially the ones where there's physical evidence, and there are a few, where it's pretty compelling that this did actually happen to these people. You know, so, you know, and there's a lesson to be learned here, too. The world is not black or white. Greg Gutfeld talks about this all the time. He talks about the prison of two ideas. It's not either or. It's either fake or it's real. Some of it's fake and some of it's real. And the thing is, you can apply this to pretty much everything. I apply this to Congress, you know. How many of the people in the Democratic Party believe all this woke bullshit? Well, here's the deal. Some of them really believe it. I think they're a minority. They really, truly buy it. The other 80% are just going along. They don't really buy any of this shit, or most of it probably not. But yeah, and this is the real weird thing that's happening right now. You know, okay, you can look at me and say I'm a partisan. Yeah, I'm a conservative guy. Okay, fine. You know, but the fact of the matter is, each party 40 years ago, the Republicans were crazy. They were. That's all there was to it. Until Newt Gingrich on the Contract for America came around, we were just fucking idiots. And I say we, even though I'm not a Republican, but I'm a conservative. So it's not that things change, you know. Now, Strom said this to me, not in this interview, but he said this to me about a year ago. It was either during an interview we were doing for a radio show or afterwards. I can't remember. But he said it's really easy to do what we do right now just because part of the left is so fucking crazy. And he's right. And we're going to talk about that in the interview here in just a second. Matter of fact, how about now? Should we do it now? Sound good? Yeah, you like that. I know you do. Here's David Strom from earlier this afternoon. Joining us from his home in North Minneapolis, David Strom, associate editor of hotair.com. Yeah, love to you, man, too. How you look good.
Well, thank you. There's nothing like having my head magnified to
yeah, I know.
size to hide the rest of my fat.
yeah. You've written a lot of stuff the last few weeks, man. I mean, it's been about 6 weeks since we've talked. So I'm just going to start off with this. And this doesn't reference any particular article. You've written just several about the fact that what is wrong with these goddamn kids on campus? They're fucking idiots. What's going on? And I don't have any problem swearing about this because I think they deserve to be sworn at. But anyway, your take.
Well, what we're seeing here, I think, is not that difficult to understand. It's the product of about 25 to 30 years of propagandization that has taken place first in the public schools and then in academia. You know, there has been, since the 1960s, a systematic successful attempt to take over educational institutions by the radical left, and we're seeing that was a great strategy for them.
Yes, it worked. William Ayer said in the 1970s, he said, yeah, we may have lost this round, but we will win by indoctrinating your children, and he was right. And you pointed this out too, nobody believed it. Nobody believed it was going to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is, you know, one of the fascinating things. The left is really protected by how open and radical they are. I mean, they'll tell you that they're planning to take over. They'll tell you that, well, gee, you know, the first and second attempts at communism didn't work, so we're going to try this. And most people laugh it off and think, well, that's ridiculous. And so people like me, people like you are pointing at them and saying, it's not a conspiracy theory. They're seeing this is what their intent is. But we come off sounding like, you know, crazy nutters, and they manage to actually succeed in doing these things.
Well, you brought this up, and that is the thing is, it's so outrageous, nobody wants to believe it. I mean, we live in one of the most liberal cities in America, and I know you, like me, virtually all my friends are liberal, including my family. And, you know, if you start talking about this stuff, the general thing is, oh, that's bullshit. You know, you're just exaggerating, right?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, you see this, you know, probably the most obvious example is the porn in schools. Nobody can wrap their head around the idea that there are instruction manuals in schools for how to log on to gay dating apps, how to get into essentially gay prostitution, how to perform various sexual acts, because it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody could want that in the schools. And so I showed my father, you know, who was talking about all Republicans want to do is censor stuff, blah,
is
blah,
your
blah.
Is your father a liberal person?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. But sort of the old 1960s, 1970s
yeah.
liberal.
Not He's liberal. A real liberal, right?
Yeah, a real liberal. Anyway, I showed him just, you know, various things out of this book. And I asked him, do you think this belongs to the school library? And his answer was, it doesn't belong in any library. but the problem is you can't do that to every single person, which is why, you know, you see all these videos. I mean, I'm terminally online, so I'm on Twitter all the time. And you see all these videos of parents going to school board meetings and complaining about this. And, you know, the school board gets all up in arms. You just want to censor people. And this is about Maya Angelou. And then a parent starts reading from the book and they'll cut the mic off.
Yeah.
You know, it's just remarkable. In fact, there is one video there where a school board member says, there are children in the audience. You can't read that. You're putting it in the school.
This is like a bad Saturday Night Live sketch. Exactly. I mean, it's like, you know, but you're right. The problem is no reasonable person actually believes it. That's why they're getting away with it. It's
yeah,
terrible.
I saw this back in the late 1990s when they were having an argument about a prior iteration of curriculum reform. All we get is curriculum reforms all the time. Anyway, so a state representative got up to speak against this, and he says, listen to what's in here. And he starts reading it, and people would say, you're a conspiracy theorist. No one would put that in the school. It's in the law right here. Look down, read this. This is what you're trying to do to kids. But it was so outrageous that it wasn't believable. And, you know, just as you know, when I told my father that the new president of the American Library Association is a Marxist, he said, oh, come on. You know, I mean, this isn't the 1950s, you know, Red Scare. And it's like, no, look at what she says. You know,
she says she's a Marxist.
That's
what she described herself. Yeah.
Yeah. And she says she wants to turn libraries into socialist organizing centers. But it just sounds so ridiculous. Not just that these people say this, but that anyone would hire them.
Yes. Right.
You know, and so a lot of this is people have trusted institutions. They will be correcting themselves enough. And so they just sort of have outsourced to the experts the ability to make these decisions. I mean, we can't be, you know, determining who's going to run an individual library or something like that.
Right.
So you have a board and all these people, and you just assume that they're rational people. But they're not. They're products of this university system. A lot of them are now relatively young, 30s and 40s, and they're radicals.
Well, you wrote about this guy in running in suburban Minneapolis. Is he running or actually on the school board? I can't remember.
He's running for the school board.
Minnesota, yeah.
But, you know, basically, you know, his argument is that You know, kids are unsafe around their parents. And so schools need to be a place where students can be themselves.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's sort of your classic Marxist notion that families are corrupting.
Right.
You know, if you have attachments to your family, you will probably also have values that are derived from that. And that's dangerous.
Of course, I mean, it is.
We live in this systemically racist culture that's, you know, white settler, colonialism, capitalism, da, 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 da. And so they're quite explicit about how they want to separate kids from their families. I mean, you've had now several major gubernatorial candidates and governors come out and say, well, parents shouldn't have any say in what's taught to their kids.
Right. I know.
It's sort of the exact opposite of what our common law tradition has had for millennia.
Now, you and I are sitting here, we're talking about this, and you're right. People are going to be watching this, and they're going to call both of us conspiracy theorists. And yeah, I admit totally, we're in an echo chamber here. We agree on almost everything. But the fact of the matter is, like you said, this has to be talked about because nobody fucking believes it's happening. That's the problem.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not that hard to, you know, if you gave me an hour to sit down with someone and just go through not what I say about these people, but just what they say about themselves and their goals, you know, it's not that hard to convince someone, although chances are that, you know, once they're an hour or two away, they're going to want to go back to their comfortable, safe space and say, well, you know, this is a fringe.
Right.
They'll admit that it's bad, but they'll say it's a fringe. Just like I was talking again to my father, and we were talking about gender ideology. And he says, well, you're really only talking about a few kids. And it's like, this is, you know, it's gone up by something like 10,000% in the past few years.
Correct.
And, you know, now we have 100 plus gender clinics in the country. You know, back in 2017, there was one.
Uh-huh.
And now we've got over 100. And even the Europeans are looking at us and saying, what is wrong with you Americans?
Yeah, that's really the amazing thing. I got to tell you, the fact that the Europeans are cutting back on this, because I always thought they've always been way more liberal than us, basically. I thought they'd run away with it, but even they're saying this is bullshit now.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. I mean, there's, in fact, in the Free Press, Barry Weiss's Free Press, there's an article came out the last couple days from the woman who was the director for Finland of their gender program. And she was explaining why they basically cut it back to zero, that they were following the guidelines that were coming out of the professional fields, you know, like WPATH, the World Professional Association of Transgender Healthcare. And they thought they were following gold standard medicine. What they found out is that the kids were getting worse. And so she said, we stopped it. Yeah. And, you know,
of course,
beyond that
makes total sense. That's what you do. But the real question is, why are the experts so wrong about freaking everything? Here's a theory I got. There's too many people doing. I was talking to Murray Sabre, the economist, yesterday. There's too many people doing everything. There's basically too many cooks in every pot. You know, and I don't know if this is the result of an overly educated population or what. But you got a whole bunch of people who are technically and credibly experts, and they don't know shit. They're wrong.
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, we've spent the past 50 years celebrating credentialism.
Celebrating what?
Credentialism.
Yeah, so okay.
Having a piece of paper.
Right.
Simultaneously in academia, in order to get ahead, you have to publish a lot and be cited a lot. And
right.
The way to be cited a lot is to say something shocking.
Yes.
And so there is an institutional bias towards being shocking. in science, there's an institutional bias to finding out something surprising.
Correct.
The worst thing that you could do, I mean, scientists are supposed to do experiments and then come up with results. Well, if you get a null result, there's nothing interesting. Well, it turns out this isn't true. And so no scientist wants to get a null result. They want something that they can sell.
Right.
And, you know, the universities have PR departments that go out and sell everything that they do. And so there's a huge incentive to come up with shocking things. And then there's another factor, and I haven't read this book yet, and I'm forgetting the author's name. But there's a book out talking about the question that you just asked. Why are experts always wrong? And why is our society fracturing? And the answer that the author comes up with is, he calls it the overproduction of elites. Mm-hmm. And when you have more people who are the credentialed class than you have prestigious jobs for them, they become very dissatisfied. And they've also been trained on how to manipulate the system.
Right.
And so you get this sort of tension and war going on both within the elite, power struggle, and then neither of them likes the people who are underneath. And so you get societal instability out of that. And again, I haven't read the book, but he actually has historical examples.
David, if anybody's watching this, that alone is worth their time here. I mean, that's a really brilliant observation. And I think it's correct. It's
not mine, but it's
Well, you got a bunch of other ones, so it's cool. You have a bunch of other brilliant observations. Let me bring up another one, talking about this guy in Minnetonka. You wrote a piece on how homeschooling is skyrocketing.
Yep.
I had no trouble with your statistics, but what I don't have any trouble with is, so it shocked the hell out of me in that piece when you said that parents who are homeschooling their children are finding out how easy it is to meet the state guidelines. Well, and then I'm thinking, okay, we're teaching gender ideology and all this shit in college, and there's no way you can get around this. There's only a set amount of time for everything. If you're doing that, you're not learning math. And that turns out that's what's going on. Nobody's actually learning anything solid.
Oh, yeah. Well, in fact, I was just reading. I do a lot of reading in science. And I was just reading an article that was written by, I forget what university. This is, I read so much that it all mushes together. But
yeah, same here.
Basically what it boiled down to is a physics professor was saying, look, I mean, we're doing remedial education for these kids that a lot of them can't do fractions.
Yeah.
And
you're talking about college, not high school, right? Yeah. College.
And these are kids who think that they're going to be physics majors, and they are so undereducated that basic math is beyond them. Algebra, it just makes them scratch their heads. And if you've ever seen what goes on in physics these days, I mean, we're long past F equals MA, you know.
I'm pretty good at math and I can't follow it.
Yeah. I mean, you'll have these, you know, 10 line long equations.
Right.
And these kids can't add fractions. It's because the schools don't care. I mean, that Minnetonka school board guy was saying, look, academics is less important than our mental health and ideological students. And so we're producing a generation or multiple generations of basically programmed people who have been dumbed down. I mean, I don't think kids are any dumber than they were 50 or 100 years ago. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that
they're smarter.
Smarter.
Right.
It's just that the intelligence that they have has been perverted by this, you know, sort of ideological drumbeat that is out there. You know, to the point where, I mean, you could have kids who will, you know, on say the Israel-Hamas battle, give you an entire, totally distorted, but an entire history of what has gone on in the Middle East, and they're just regurgitating basically Hamas propaganda, but they're not idiots. They're just very poorly educated.
The one thing that struck me in the news yesterday, and I don't understand why nobody's really paying attention to this, about the misinformation that goes on TikTok, and TikTok's essentially owned by the Chinese government. Yes, exactly. So what are you expecting? I mean, I don't understand these, you know, you can get on the, I read that the pro-Hamas videos on TikTok outweigh the pro-Israeli ones by like 5 or 6 to 1. But,
oh, easy, yeah.
Yeah, and you know that some of those quote-unquote influencers are being paid by the Chinese government, and yet nobody's... First of all, nobody cares, and secondly, especially the kids, they don't believe it. I don't understand how people can be so stupid.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure it's stupid. It's people have comfort zones. And, you know, if you have developed a framework, everything you hear fits one narrative, and then there's this information that's being projected to you that comes from an entirely different perspective, your tendency is just to say, well, that's bullshit. I may not know everything, but here's the body of knowledge that I have.
Yeah.
And that body of knowledge these days is, sorry.
That's all right. That's okay.
That body of knowledge has been carefully curated over the past, you know, 50 years to create the sort of Marxist alternative universe that's out there. I mean, you can talk to a lot of these kids, and now I'm talking about people in their 20s, teens and 20s, who will just say the Holocaust was just pure propaganda. And some of them will just say, look, the Jews should be gassed. I mean, in I think it was New York City, there was a protest there where they actually chanted about gassing the Jews.
Yeah.
And there's another, I just saw this on Twitter today, where a Jew who looks just like a Palestinian, because a lot of them do. I mean, they're not, you know, genetically, they're not that different, at least.
Right. That's right.
You know, put on a keffiyeh, went to a protest and started interviewing people, you know, and when you say from the river to the sea, what do you do with the Jews? And, you know, several of them say things like, well, they should just all go to hell. Or, you know, or they have no right to live. And so, you know,
did you ever think we get to the point where basically people are essentially parroting Nazi propaganda?
Not quite. First of all, Nazi propaganda, as much as the Nazis and the Soviets hated each other, they were a lot less different than you would think. I mean,
no shit. You know? Yeah.
And the Soviet Union, you know, parroted that same propaganda about the Jews as the Nazis. So it was
Stalin
more like
was a great guy.
Yeah. It was more sort of that internecine warfare, just as when China and the Soviet Union were, you know, I mean, they went to war a couple times. You know, the Chinese communists and the Soviet communists. So it, but yeah, I mean, I've been expecting communist stuff to be becoming more and more frequent, and it has been.
Yes.
I did not expect hundreds of thousands of people proudly coming out for genocide.
Yeah.
It's scary. But it's also fascinating because there's this great sociological experiment going on. What do liberal Jews do? You know, and in fact, you can look at the Biden administration is having a huge problem here.
No shit.
And, you know, you probably noticed that yesterday they came out with their national strategy against Islamophobia.
Yeah, really.
Which doesn't exist.
Right.
you know, one of the most coddled classes in the United States. And the reason why they did that, I mean, they're obviously, you know, have been supporting Israel. So why are they doing this as Islamophobia thing? Because a huge part of their base is angry at them for supporting Israel.
Right.
And so they're trying to thread a needle here. And, you know, so it's going to be fascinating to see, you know, what the sort of liberal Jews who have been treated very badly, in, you know, over the past 20 years or so within the Democratic Party, are they going to stick it out? And I expect a lot of them will. You know, I mean, you could have the New York Times version of Jews where it's sort of that self-loathing, you know.
Yeah, Woody Allen, right, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And again, I keep on coming back to my dad. My grandmother was Jewish. And my parents were both atheists, you know, and I'm a Catholic convert, but, you know.
Hey, I'm just curious, is your father still an atheist?
I believe so.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was talking to him about, this was before October 7th, and I was trying to figure out why he was so hostile to Israel. You know, sort of after probing, it all came down to basically, I expect Jews to be better than other people. <You know? laughs> And so there's this sort of sense of guilt that Jews have had a state, that they've been defending themselves. And in having to defending themselves, they've had to do what every other national group has had to do, which is at times commit violence. And his sort of subterranean notion is that, you know, Jews are supposed to be victims. That's sort of their global role over history. I call it the whipping boy theory.
Yeah, right. That's right.
You know, they're supposed to pay for all the rest of our sins.
Right.
And
in any social construct, there seems to be always one group that is the whipping boy. Right.
Yeah.
It's a human thing almost. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and part of that, the way Christianity deals with this need is recognizing that we're all fallen. That
well, would you agree that basically Jesus is the whipping boy?
Yes, that's
right.
In fact, that is exactly the Christian notion. I mean, he died for our sins,
right?
And you know, but for, you know, people need that because we're all.
Yeah, sinners. Isn't that strange? That people do need it.
And so for a lot of people, it's the Jews.
Let me bring another. I have another theory on this, too. I think that the Jews, and I use as the analog gay men, I think a lot of it's driven by envy. The Jews have a very pragmatic, very successful social culture. They do. I mean, look at Tel Aviv. 50 years, one of the greatest cities in the world. They're very good at doing shit positively. They are. And the thing, reason I bring up gay men is because I think a lot of straight men are envious of gay men regarding the sexual availability they have, and they're dealing with people that think like them, and any straight man who's ever dealt with a straight woman knows it's not the same. So I think a lot of it's driven by envy, too.
Well, also, I mean, gay men tend to be high income, well educated,
and also usually they don't have children. They don't have new kids.
Right. So you know, they live a much freer lifestyle.
Right.
You know, not always a healthy lifestyle, but a freer lifestyle. And so, yeah, there's an element of envy there. Not to mention that, you know, a lot of them are good looking.
Yeah, so, that's that too. Yeah. See, I never thought of that. But yeah, you got a point.
But with, you know, Jews and Asians both have a tremendous amount of resentment aimed at them because of what you have said. In fact, Thomas Sowell, I just saw an interview with him from way back, and he was asked, so why do people hate the Jews? And he talked about the Jews and the Asians. He says there are a lot of people who look at, you know, Jews or Asians, and they see that they can start with nothing and build something up. And, you know, by the second or third generation, they've got a business and they're doing well and their kids are doctors and lawyers.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people look at themselves and say, well, how come I haven't done that? And so they have a choice. They can either hate themselves for, you know, being schmucks, or they can hate those people.
That's a really good point. I never thought about it that way. You're absolutely right.
You know, yeah. But I mean, you know, look at Hong Kong. Hong Kong in the 1960s, back when Milton Friedman was first pointing it out, was small, still relatively poor. Although he was pointing out that it was growing very quickly. Now you look at Hong Kong today, or at least, you know, before the Chinese communists took it over, and, you know, one of the freest places in the world, extraordinarily prosperous, and they had nothing. I mean, right. You know, a few square miles, and they right. built it up into something. Israel, I mean, it's not exactly, you know, a land with milk and honey.
No.
It's a desert. No. I mean, in order to, they need to desalinate to get water.
Right.
You know, it's not resource rich, but they've turned it into
it's a dusty piece of real estate. That's what it is. Yeah. There's nothing there.
And then you look at Gaza, and, you know, we keep on being told, by the way, that they're refugee camps in Gaza. It's like, I'm sorry. Palestinians have been living there for decades. Nobody is a refugee anymore.
Right.
I mean, it's like, you know, I've got some neighbors who came from Vietnam and they've settled here. And, you know, I don't look at them and say they're living in a refugee camp. You know, you've got to build a life. And what they have done there is they've channeled all their energy into hate rather than building something.
Correct. That's right.
And, you know, that's sort of the history, and it's a tragic history of the Palestinian people. I've met plenty of Palestinians who have just left and gone on to live good, productive lives as engineers and others. But, you know, instead of wasting all their energy on hate, they decided to build a life. That could be, you know, in Gaza, you know, the European Union will pour tens of millions of dollars into building water infrastructure, and Hamas will go and dig it up and turn the pipes into rockets to shoot at Israel. I mean, there's really nothing, you know, they're never going to get out of the sort of medieval mindset, or at least living as medieval peasants, until they decide we want to build something, not destroy something.
I was running this by Murray Sabrin yesterday. So as far as I can tell, if you go back to the 19th century, pre-20th century, and history before then, most wars were fought over resources. Like, somebody has something I either need or want, and I'm going to go get it. Since at least the middle of the 20th century, if not now wars are fought off over basically just hate. We all, the world pretty much has enough stuff to do whatever we want. And some people may be starving, but there's still enough food actually to feed everybody. So there's no, you know, they're fighting over hate. There's nothing, it's not that we need this piece of land or we need that water or any of that sort of shit. You know?
Oh, yeah. No, there hasn't been a famine in the world that was caused by lack of food, at least 70 years.
Yeah, right. That'd be right.
You know, certainly at least since the Green Revolution. And so, you know, yeah, it all boils down to getting the other guy for whatever reason, hate, ideology. And you're right. I mean, the resources, I mean, Iraq invading Kuwait, that was about oil. But that's is really, you know, that is now an unusual war.
Right. And I have to say, Stabron brought that up, too. That might be the exception to my argument, and you might be right. But, yeah, but still, you know, it's still the exception that proves the rule, if you ask me, you know.
Yeah, no, I think you're basically right. And pretty much every, I mean, if you look at, say, you know, Mao's Cultural Revolution, that was about hate. You know, I don't know whether this is just something buried in the human soul or if there's something about the wealth that we have, relative wealth in the world, tied to an instinctive need to fight, that leads people in a different direction. Maybe human beings are just warlike.
Well, okay, you're talking about Marxism and communism. That seems to be the onus there. Instead of everyone achieving, and like Sabron was saying, capitalism is essentially a win-win proposition. When you trade, no one loses, but Marxism decides we're going to make certain that everybody's equal. So to do that, you have to pull people down rather than build people up, you know? And that's basically why, if you ask me, why it's inherently evil, you know?
Yeah, well, and it's based upon a fundamental misunderstanding of what creates wealth. I mean, the reason why, once you get outside of force and fraud, which clearly exists, ask Sam Bankman-Fried, you know?
Yeah, right.
You know, but in sort of a basic, you know, way, what makes something wealth is not the thing in itself. It's the knowledge that's applied to it. I mean, if you took every single resource that's in an Apple iPhone, it's probably $50 worth, maybe a lot less than that. But if you hand someone, a truly broken iPhone, to them, it's just something that you throw in the trash. I mean, what makes it valuable is the human intellect that took that relatively worthless junk and turned it into something that's extraordinarily valuable. And what communism, and we've seen this time and again with communism, once you take away the inequality that exists, that inequality is built upon the ability to take things that are worthless and turn it into wealth, you essentially lose all wealth creation. That's why you get Cuba. That's why you get
Venezuela.
Yeah. You know, it's based upon a fundamental misunderstanding of what wealth is. I mean, in fact, it goes back to Marx. I mean, his labor theory of value, where what makes something valuable is how much effort went into it. And, you know, that's just ridiculously stupid. It's like, yes, saying, you know, if you've got a farmer who's only got a hoe and you've got another farmer who, you know, has got all modern equipment, that the corn, you know, that's produced by each of them aggregated actually should be worth more from the guy who's got the hoe, even though he's got a lot less of it. He sweat more.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's just a ridiculous understanding.
There's another thing about that, too, and Sabron agreed with me on this. I think one of the fundamental flaws in Marxism is it does not take into account the concept of human possession. Yeah. Even babies know they own their sucker, that sucker belongs. I mean, humans know when shit belongs to them. And communism says, oh, we'll just take it all. It doesn't belong to you, and that's like it's unnatural, you know.
Well, the root of the word property is proper, and what it's referring to is that thing is proper to you. It is part of you. Locke discusses this in his two treatises on government, What's the Origin of Property? And it is very fundamental to our understanding of sort of the way the world works, our psychology. If you look, people take care of their own stuff better than they take care of communally owned stuff.
For sure.
Tragedy of the commons.
That's right.
You know, it's just, but all of these ideological constructs out there are abstracting away from human psychology. I mean, essentially, they'll even tell you they want to build a new type of human being.
Yeah.
Because the current type of human being is fundamentally defective.
Yes.
Christianity acknowledges that human being are fundamentally flawed. We're fallen. But it has a very different way of approaching this. I mean, it's not wrong to say that, grotesque selfishness is a vice. But it's also not wrong to say that, on average, selfishness is one of the things that makes the world go around.
Right.
A business owner is going to spend a lot more time taking care of his store than his employee will.
That's correct.
I mean, it's just a fundamental fact of life. And, you have to build your society around what's true and what's real.
Right, the way people think.
Yeah.
I want to get on to one of our, greatest hits, and that is the fucking press. What the hell? What is with the, you've been writing about this, the New York Times. What, you wrote about something just today. What was it that they came up? Oh, they're trying to justify, they're saying, like, Hamas maybe isn't that bad, or it's like, this is crazy people. They're crazy people.
Yeah, well, I mean, the New York Times, going back a century, has had this, I don't even know what drives it, but, you go back to, say, the Soviet Times, Walter Duranty.
Right.
Who won a Pulitzer Prize for,
yes,
for covering Russia in the 1930s, just lied about the Holodomor. He just said that nobody was starving in Ukraine. All these reports coming out of Ukraine are false. Here's what Stalin says. And they've been doing that pretty much continually ever since. And there's sort of one stream that has been consistent, which is a sort of modest anti-Americanism. I wouldn't say that, at least until recently, the New York Times has fundamentally hated America, but it's obsessed with the notion that we are fundamentally flawed. And
it seems to be, yeah.
And of course, for the Times, Israel is an extension of the United States. It's the outpost of the West,
right,
in the Middle East. It has always been strongly tied to the United States, at least since the 1960s. Probably Nixon onward. Mm-hmm. So there's been this hostility to Israel, and it has grown, I think, as Israel has moved right. Now, Israel is ideologically very different. I mean, you can't translate left and right here over there. But when it, through the 1970s, it was very left-wing, social.
Uh-huh.
And the kibbutzim are essentially, little communes. What happened was, Israel just wasn't moving forward like it should have. And it's just drifted both economically and politically right. And the New York Times went from skeptical of Israel to really just, I don't want to say hating it, but it's the same sort of thing as I described with my father. You know, they should be better than that. They should know better than that.
I want to get back to what you were talking about before, and I should have picked up on this at that time, about the fact that it appears it will be crazy if the Democratic Party doesn't lose a bunch of liberal Jewish voters. But the question is how much. Now, we had a panel discussion here a couple nights ago on Halloween of all times. So and I swore on Halloween we were not going to talk about anything serious. We ended up talking about something serious. So I think a lot of the panel agreed with you. It might not even be the majority of Jews that leave the Democratic Party, but it'll probably be enough to influence the election. I mean, at this point, it looks like there's a whole bunch of stuff that's just going, besides his own incompetence, going against Joe Biden. You know,
my analysis of why they came out with this Islamophobia national strategy is they're losing Arabs in Michigan.
Yeah, that was you, right, that said that, right? And I never thought about that till I read that. And you're right, that's probably the problem they're trying to address.
And it's probably, I mean, the problem with losing Jews, given their concentration in probably three states, New York, California, and Florida.
Yeah.
It won't matter in any of those three. Because Florida is going to go red, New York and California are going to go blue no matter what. But a lot of their intellectual class is Jewish or sympathetic to the Jews, and a lot of money donors are Jewish or sympathetic to the Jews. And so my sense is that the White House really feels like they're in between a rock and a hard place here, because the choice is pretty binary, right? You know, whose side are you on here?
Right.
And all the energy in the Democratic Party is anti-Israel, and all the sort of elite, or most of them, are pro-Israel. And so I think that, you know, it's sort of a lose-lose for them at the moment.
Willing to expand that to the population at large, in the sense that right now, generally in the whole population, the elites are basically against going against the will of the majority of voters. Almost everything, let alone this, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think my impression is that there has been this huge chipping away. This goes back to what I was talking about before, which is we tend to have sort of a information-based worldview, narrative, whatever, where things are supposed to fit. And it's very hard to break that narrative. But over time, things can chip away at it. And that has been happening during the Biden administration. I mean, the Biden administration was supposed to be the restoration, right?
Yeah.
The normal was coming.
Going
back to normal. We're going back to sane, you know, however they presented it. And the reality has been everything has gotten worse. And, you know, it's not any one of those things that is chipping away at people's sense that, you know, the Democrats are doing a good job. It's all of them together. And, you know, I think for some people, the breaking point is going to be this fight, Israel. For other people, it's been inflation. For other people, it's just sort of this sense that the world is unraveling.
Don't leave the border out. Holy shit.
Oh, yeah, the border.
Yeah.
Well, another conversation with my dad, you know, we were talking about the border, and he says, oh, come on, this is just, you know, some mothers, fathers, and children coming over. And so I showed him videos. And it's like, no, that's not what I thought was happening.
And getting back to the press, as far as I know, Fox News is the only outlet showing the video. No one else is showing it, even though they might talk about it, but they don't show it.
Yeah. But there has been just sort of this accumulation. It's like the media tries very hard to cover for Biden's corruption. But as you've seen over the past year and a half or so, the public has sort of come around to the idea that, yeah, he probably is corrupt.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's the chipping away. It's not any one thing. It's just everything.
So I'm guessing you're going to agree with me on this, that if they end up running an impeachment, he will not be convicted. He will stay, you know. Right. But my question is, do you think it's worth running the impeachment, even though they know that ahead of time?
I think it is very worthwhile to run the impeachment investigation. As for the impeachment, no. You know, unless he gets reelected, you know, there are a lot of reasons why I think it would be a mistake. One of which is, to a lot of people, it would just seem like, oh, you're doing this out of retaliation because of Trump. And, you know, they'll find some way to focus on the impeachment rather than the evidence. We're going to have an argument about whether, you know, Joe Biden should be impeached and, you know, is this a witch hunt and everything. Yeah. But if you just keep on dripping out the evidence, it accumulates. And so, I mean, my argument back when we were having this big fight over who was going to be speaker is, you know, was pretty simple, which was, we're taking attention away from impeachment inquiries.
Yeah, right. That was also, I had a big thing about Jim Jordan is a fantastic guy and he probably make a great speaker, but he's doing such a great job revealing all this shit. That's one of those things where I don't know if you want to promote a guy right now, you know, which is terrible for him, but really it's like, you know,
well,
I think it worked out well.
You know, I think there's absolutely, it actually makes no difference who the speaker is, except if they're a Republican or Democrat.
Right.
Things are so tight right now that accumulating enough votes for a majority on anything is almost impossible. You could have the most conservative Republican or the most liberal Republican, and you are going to get essentially the same outcome because what matters is not who is speaker right now. It does matter when there's a larger majority.
Yes.
Because you can whip people, you can, you know, cobble together a majority. But right now, I mean, the six votes or whatever, you know, and you've lost. And so it doesn't matter. I mean, you could put George Santos up there and it wouldn't.
Yeah.
you know, the outcome will be just the same.
Right.
So I thought that was a worthless fight. I also think that it was kind of petty.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, I mean, Kevin McCarthy was doing about as good a job as anybody there could do.
That's what I thought, too.
And you know, the idea that McCarthy, there are rhinos there, but McCarthy wasn't one of them. Now, he had to deal with them in order to collect the votes. But it's not really a betrayal because that's exactly what's going to happen no matter who the speaker
right.
is.
He was also quite good at raising money, too. Yeah. Where I don't know if Mike Johnson is going to be that successful at that, but whatever. You know, I want to ask you about, because this is really important. You wrote a piece a few days ago about Trump. So I will just summarize the way I saw this. Is your feelings about Trump, you have mixed feelings because you thought he did a really good job as president, but you don't like him because personally he's an asshole.
That I've always thought that Donald Trump was an asshole.
Yeah.
Going back to, you know, the 1980s, I disliked the guy. And I was very pleasantly surprised by how well he did, especially in the environment. In which he had to do things. But, I mean, you go back, you know, well, he took it on the chin on everything. But for the elite, they kept on whining about his foreign policy and da 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 da. You know, he's alienating our allies. And it's like, look at the world today. I mean, this is the world with the adults in charge.
Right, right.
At, you know, we're shipping off billions to Iran, who's shipping it off to Hamas to go, you know, rape, murder, and kill people. You've got Russia in Ukraine. You know, and I saw some liberal who said, well, if Trump were president, he would have just handed Ukraine over. And it's like, Trump was president. Right?
And they keep forgetting that. That's right. Yeah. Trump was president, and the democracy did not collapse.
Yes. and he didn't hand over Ukraine. In fact, he was the first president to send them arms. Obama didn't. So under Obama, Russia invades Ukraine. Under Biden, Russia invades Ukraine. Under Trump, the only time that they don't invade Ukraine, and you're saying, well, you would have just handed it over. It's like, dude, you're just broken.
I know. It's not hypothetical. That's the thing. No. It's like they keep thinking, well, if he was president. Well, he was president. You're absolutely right. Yeah. I do, David. I do have to.
It's like, what are you talking about? You know,
I do have to bring something up here, though. I don't necessarily disagree with you about Trump being an asshole, but I like to quote Tina Fey, who in her biography said, sometimes it takes a bitch to get things done. Sometimes it takes an asshole to get things done, you know? That's my feeling about it.
My argument about Trump, in fact, I think I said it in this piece, the biggest reason not to vote for Trump is 2020. You know, I think he just really fucked up in 2020. He handed over the country to bureaucrats when he should have known better. But even there, I think it goes to, you know, Trump's strength and his weakness were the same there. Trump is extraordinary at outwitting people.
Yes, he is. That's true.
The problem that he had here is his opponent was microscopic. He had no tools to deal with this. And so, and even he said, you know, said, well, I've hired the best people to deal with this. And they turned out to be backstabbing betrayers, you know, who, you know, were essentially homicidal maniacs.
Yeah.
You know, so 2020 for me is sort of a repudiation of everything that he did before. Now, I would still vote for him. I mean, you know, and I think he's learned his lesson on that. But he's also very bad at hiring people. And even he will tell you this. I mean, he won't say I'm bad at hiring people. He just, every time, you know, anyone leaves, he's talking about bad mouthing them.
Uh-huh.
Like, well, dude, you hired him.
Yeah, right. You know? That's right.
I mean, if he really sucks that badly, you know, what kind of hiring manager are you?
Yeah.
And I mean, who does he speak well of? Work for him?
That's a good question. I mean, I think maybe Nikki Haley. I'm not sure. Not now, of course. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. You know? It's a vanishingly small number of people. You know, every single person who is his chief of staff, his right hand man, he will just tell you how awful they are and they're backstabbers and they were never any good. It's like, well, dude, you hired him.
I don't think anybody's going to disagree with you that he is a very petty man. You know, it's like, but you know, like you said, he generally did a really good job. You know, and that's the reason I think so many people are supporting him now. It's really based on past experience.
Well, and in politics, probably 90% of the battles that you are going to fight are against other people. And he's just extraordinary at that.
Yeah.
You know, his other big weakness is he doesn't understand the deep state. He knows the deep state is bad. It's evil. He knows that the swamp needs to be drained, but they actually ran circles around him.
My theory on that is that he knew the deep state was there, but I think he was caught off guard by how incredibly deep it is.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing.
Do you expect the FBI to be to the point where, you know, they're shopping around fraudulent stuff. They're lying to federal courts. They're actively covering up for other politicians. I mean, if you had told me that in 2017, I would have said you're a conspiracy theorist.
Right. That's right.
But it turns out that, yes, our institutions are so fundamentally corrupt that I had this argument with my brother-in-law, who...
Is he a liberal, too?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah.
In fact, his kids were there, and they rolled their eyes. Dad's a Democrat. but he's a lawyer. And, you know, I just... I said, look, you're a lawyer. I mean, the FBI lied to a federal court. And he's like, no, they didn't. It's like, even the court said that they lied. The inspector general said that they lied. People lost their jobs for lying to the federal court. And it's like, no, they didn't. And, you know, they needed to take out Trump.
Yeah, of course they did. That's right. That's the reason. That's the rationale. Right.
That's defending democracy.
Right.
You know, it's like,
exactly.
We have to burn the village down to save it.
Right, right. I want to end with this, David, and this you did not write. This is about, I don't know if you heard about this. Elon Musk was on the Joe Rogan program again. Also, you know, for somebody who does this, I'm fascinated by these 2.5-hour interviews. I have no idea why people plow through this, but, you know, we're pushing an hour, but still, you know. So the thing is, Elon said a couple interesting things. He said he bought Twitter specifically to save democracy because he thought it was having so much influence on the world stage via misinformation from the left that something had to be done. But there's one kind of quote that almost got lost that he said almost an aside. And he said, you know, the media thinks Twitter is real. And what I mean is, what he meant is real life. Yeah. And I know he's right. And I just find that absolutely fascinating. It's a fucking bulletin board. I mean, if you think this is real life, you're nuts.
Well, I saw this when Twitter, first hit it big. I was still dealing with the media a fair amount. And there were a couple political reporters who I thought were, you know, reasonably good. They leaned left, but you could talk to them. And suddenly they disappeared. But they were still writing. And what I discovered is 100% of their interaction with the world was on Twitter. And so everything was driven by that. Suddenly they were in a silo and you couldn't talk to them. They became fundamentally irrational. It had a very kind of scary psychological impact on them. It is sort of their world. And it's because they live in a world of narratives. It's not like they're, you know, in a retail world where you're talking to a wide variety of people or anything like that.
Right.
They're in this very small, constrained world. And it was constrained even before Twitter because if you've ever been in a state capital for any period of time, and this is probably true at the U.S. Capitol, it's kind of like a high school campus or a college campus. You've got the cool kids, everyone talks to everyone else and nobody talks to anyone outside that campus.
Right.
At least when they're there. And so there's no reality check, which is why in Minnesota, you know, most of the bills would be written before Easter break. And then Easter break would happen and suddenly, boom, people come back and it's like, well, I don't think we can do that. And I don't think we can do that. We really ought to focus on this because they had gone home.
Yeah, right.
And you know, everything that everyone was talking about at the Capitol, people would look at them and it's like, why the hell do you care about that? You know, we've got a problem where the Department of Agriculture is coming here and telling us that, you know, we've got to change our gutters. You know? I can't farm within so many feet of a ditch or something.
Yeah. Right.
You know, those were the issues that people cared about. And, you know, but it's all green energy, you know. It's like, what the fuck are you doing? You know?
Yeah.
Well, if your entire life is Twitter, you're like one more step removed.
And, now, and it's amazing how many people do truly live online. I just find this absolutely incredible. But it's basically that the entire, even their social existence is online. And this is not good for humanity. This just isn't. No. I don't, you know, I have no problem just saying that.
No, and I'm guilty of this. I get a tremendous fraction of my human interaction through this screen.
Yeah. Yeah, but I do want to point something out. You're actually getting paid to do it. There's a lot of people who are doing this or not, don't have a job, you know. They're literally just doing it. Now, that maybe excuses some of the press, too, who live online, like yourself. But I'm fascinated by the people who are there, who are online 24 hours a day. I mean, do they don't seem to have jobs. You know, I don't know.
No, but there are people for whom it's where they get their dopamine hits.
Yeah.
You know? For instance, I'm on Twitter a lot. I almost never post. Probably 90% of my posts are just a post of my article. And I try to make sure to have the widest possible range of things that I read. You know, there are just certain things where it's not like I'm going to The Nation all the time, because most of it is crap. It's not even worth reading. But even there, I will go there. I mean, there are magazines out there that infuriate me sometimes, but I keep on going back because there's also good stuff. Magazines like The Atlantic, where, you know, I feel like it's schizophrenic. But you've got to get as many points of view as possible. Otherwise, you're just living within a terrible bubble. And I see this actually with, you know, it's not just people on one side of the aisle. It happens to people on both sides of the aisle.
Yes, it does.
And, you know, people who need their personal narrative reinforced. And, you know, it short circuits rationality and empathy.
Correct. It does. Anything you want to add before we're done here? Anything you want
to? Read my articles on podcast.com.
I will put a link up to your author page on Hot Air. So we'll do that. Yeah. I can't thank you enough. You know, I always love this. Time always flies. So we busted an hour again.
Yeah.
I honestly don't, you know, we do this and it's great to us, and people listen to Joe Rogan for 3 hours and okay, fine. You know, I don't know if I could, which is terrible. I mean, I'm doing the show, you know. But, you know, I love talking to you, and you have a lot to say. So,
all right. Well, I
did not mean that as a backhanded insult either. I didn't. So I hope
I didn't. I'm not even sure what it would have been. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, you take care. We'll talk to you soon. All right.
All right. Bye.
Thanks. David Strong, the associate editor of HotAir.com. What an interesting guy. Seriously, I talked to him forever. That was 65 minutes long, and we were talking afterwards. It seemed like 15 to me, but I hope you enjoyed it. So, at any rate, we're going to wrap up tonight. Next week, Wednesday, debate night. Like I said, I think the debate ends at 11 p.m. Eastern. I'm not sure. I have to check on that now, because I think I heard they made a time change or something like that. But anyway, we're on Wednesday night. We're going live as soon as the debate's done. Panel discussion. I won't name them. I pretty much know who the panelists are already, but I'll name them later. Thursday night, I'm taking off. I'm going to a funeral. Monday and Tuesday, I'm hoping to have a guest on Tuesday night. Monday night, you just might end up listening to me yakking. I don't know, but that's not bad. You know, I talk about the UFOs. I look like a crazy person. And my eyebrows are starting to go gray, you know. Good times, huh? Anyway, thank you folks for listening. We busted on Rumble, we busted 750 followers today. So I want to thank you guys for that, too. Appreciate it. So anyway, we'll see you next week. I hope you have a nice weekend. I'll see you on Monday. Good night, Esperanza. Good night, Uncle Donnie. And good night to you, wherever you are. Have a nice weekend.